Bess is lying on her bed, communing with her dead father's spirit and dreaming of escape, when she hears the bang of the front door, followed by scurrying footsteps. The urgent noises remind her of the day news of Pa's last fateful voyage arrived, the one which split her life into two phases, before and after. Creeping into the corridor, she peers down the stairwell to see Alice join her mother beside the front door. The two women confer quietly, heads inclined. Bess cranes as far forward as she dares, watching her mother's agitated gestures, the emphatic flick of her wrist. What can she be saying? What has happened? There's still enough light for Bess to discern the worry lines around her mother's mouth, the way she splays her hand against the timber door as if the needle is a fortress she must defend, an English-built Batavia ringed by trenches and canals and coconut trees stretching up into a godless sky. A baby, Bess thinks suddenly, and her interest sours. Something has gone wrong and Mam is being called out to make an urgent delivery. Nothing else could possibly inspire her mother to such a state of heightened animation. Mam thinks of nothing but babies, unless she's in her garden, and then it's herbs that occupy her mind. If Bess were a hollyhock, Mam might notice her for long enough to inquire about her day, or take the time to encourage her hopes and dreams. But Bess is just a girl, unworthy of her mother's attention, her feelings of less value than a mewling infant's. It's not surprising Mam misunderstood her interest in the hangings. If Pa were here, he would have understood her curiosity. He understood everything. Unwilling to linger any longer in the musty corridor, Bess retreats to the sanctuary of her bedroom. If Mam goes out, at least there will be no interruptions. Bess takes comfort in the books and curios, the empty birdcage glowing in the last strands of daylight through the shutters. She trails her hand along a japanned box left over from her days at Mrs. Priest's school. The timber box is black and silky smooth, beautified by layer upon layer of varnish. Bess wonders what became of the other box she started but never finished. Did some other girl complete it in her absence, one whose parents could absorb the fees set by Mrs. Priest, the proprietor? Bess spent 2 years at the school before her parents lost the surgery, and with it, the means of paying. She remembers little of the school now, except how worthless the other students, the daughters of middle-class shopkeepers and clergymen and merchants, made her feel. Her only comforts were Johnny when he was home from school, and her little bird, the absence of which still pains her. And Pa, of course. An abundance of treasures is spread out on the bed, her late father's belongings, the objects of her ritual. Bess touches them one by one, absorbing their fraternal power. She cups a notched tortoise shell in her left hand, then sets it down and picks up a tiger-striped nautilus. Stroking the smooth spine, she lifts it to her ear, wondering if Pa's voice might somehow breach the divide and drift back to her. Nothing comes but the whispering sea. She plucks an old tankard off the counterpane, the handle a bare-breasted mermaid, locks of yellowed ivory flowing to her waist. Bess is especially pleased with this item, since she discovered it months after Pa's passing, hidden under the dresser in the kitchen. It must have rolled under there one night and miraculously escaped her mother's mass purge of anything valuable. Now it belongs to her, a reminder of her father's wild adventures. Although the liquid contents evaporated long ago, Bess fancies she can still detect the aroma of ale, her father's drink of choice if something stronger, burgundy, for example, was not available. Under its yeasty spell, his stories grew increasingly fantastical and elaborate. Bess remembers the shadowed world of the kitchen springing to life as she sat cross-legged, staring up at him. She remembers a chair transforming into a sultan's throne, the table rumbling in her father's hands as a Lima earthquake trembled the house. She remembers Henry, her father's manservant, laughing as Pa pretended to pluck a handful of grapes off their stems and pop them into his mouth, only to spit them back out in surprise. Bess counted the grapes, gleaming in the rosy warmth of the firelight. 6 hard little nuggets of purest gold, treasure worth 100 silk dresses or a fleet of ships as grand as the Swift. Pa had beckoned her over, tipping the pellets into her cupped hands. "Your treasure now," he'd said, the last words he ever spoke to her. Before climbing into bed, she'd placed the gold carefully under the loose floorboard in her bedroom, dreaming of all the places it would take her. India, China, the ice-cold waters of the North Sea, Jamaica, Bermuda, Bombay, places even Pa hadn't been. They would go to sea together and share the spoils. In the morning the gold was gone, but Pa had left a note in its place, promising he would return. The note is so fragile when she fishes it out of the cup. She's afraid it will crumble to dust as she unfolds it. But here it is, the proof she cannot let go, his promise to return. Bess chants the words to herself, an incantation of longing. "Come back," she says, the sound of her own voice startling and childlike. Breath held, she strains for an echo, an answer, but there is only the house, creaking and settling like the joists of a great ship, sailing them all into the dark.